It's truly a pleasure. I get to introduce our next guest. It's Dr. Joseph Zwitschenberger from the University of Kentucky. He is currently the Johnson Wright Professor of Surgery and the Chairman, and also holds an appointment as a Professor of Pediatrics. He's going to talk to us today about non-invasive ventilation. Thank you.
Well, thank you, Bryce. I've been doing ECMO now for quite some time, and it always tickles me when I'm asked to give a talk on something that I haven't previously given a talk on, because that means I have to actually think about it and work on it. First of all, I have to disclose that I have a number of conflicts, a number of contracts, and I'm heavily conflicted with devices used for ECMO, but unfortunately, I don't have any devices in non-invasive ventilation. This all started for me back in 1984, when I did a fellowship with Bob Bartlett. We would run to the bedside of neonates and put them on veno arterial ECMO. And what's remarkable about this photo is that Dr. Bartlett has dark hair and I have hair at all. After that, it started a 35-year friendship and collaboration, which culminated for us in the first ECMO Red Book, which is now in its first edition, to talk about all the aspects of neonatal, pediatric, and adult ECMO care and critical care surrounding it. However, I'm here to talk today about non-invasive ventilation, which is somewhat of a shock because here I've just spent my whole life being a critical care physician, taking care of patients in the crucifix position, intubated, on central line access, arterial line, fully catheter, fully monitored, and now I'm going to talk about how to back away from all that and try to get your patients through a respiratory illness without having to go through that. Well, first of all, there's a number of different products out there, and it's important to know there's been quite an evolution and revolution in this technology in the last 3 to 4 years. So if you haven't had a talk on non-invasive ventilation in the last 2 or 3 years, or if you're not good buddies with your local respiratory therapist, you've missed some good stuff. First of all, the interface is completely different than you're used to. Everybody in this room is either an expert, or at least at one time was an expert at intubation and managing ventilators. But CPAP and BiPAP have a mask that fits over the face, and the close-fitted, tight adjunct to the face to where you can get a seal is very important. Nothing to do with intubation. Whereas high-flow nasal cannulas require a seal at the nares. So the devices are different too. Back when I was a fellow, I took apart a ventilator and could rebuild a Bird ventilator, an MA1 ventilator, and knew exactly how they worked. I suspect most of you do too. But non-invasive ventilation uses different technology that you're not really familiar with and are basically flow meters. So it starts out with there are basically three types of non-invasive ventilation. You've heard of all of them, but you may not be able to wrap your head around the difference until you really dig into it. CPAP is continuous positive airway pressure. And I was talking to my daughter who just finished her fellowship at Duke, and she goes, "Daddy, it's like sticking your head out the door of a car and having an air hit you in the face." And I think that's pretty good because it gives you a feel for what it's like to have that coming at you. And there's really no regulation. BiPAP has inhalation and exhalation control. So you give positive pressure on inhalation, and you exhale against a lower residual pressure, which we've come to know and love as PEEP. High-flow nasal cannula is a different concept. You use high-flow at 40 to 60 liters per minute of flow rammed in your nose, which is warmed and humidified, and you adjust the FiO2 and the flow so that you generate oxygen-rich gas in the lungs, and you also generate a pressure which is analogous to PEEP. Supposedly you get improved oxygenation and a improved functional residual capacity, and it also somehow improves your mucociliary clearance by allowing your humidified gas to mobilize secretions. So let's talk some more about those which are familiar to everybody, CPAP and BiPAP. CPAP is the same pressure on inspiration and expiration. You really can't augment ventilation. You're breathing against this force of air against your face. And it works better for oxygenation problems. Whereas BiPAP has two different pressures, as we talked about, the high pressure on inspiration and a lower pressure that holds against your exhale to try to stent open the alveoli. And you can adjust the tidal volumes and augment blood gases. So let's dig down as to when it's best used. Well, it's better to use CPAP to splint open the airways and keep that constant pressure on your face. Remember your dog sticking its head out the window of obstructive sleep apnea. Because recent literature shows that many of our surgical patients are closet obstructive sleep apnea patients, and they just don't talk about it. Well, all you have to do is look at your patients or go to Walmart, whichever comes first, and you see how big a problem obesity is, and how often we have obstructive sleep apnea in our patient population. BiPAP has been said to be a bridge to intubation. In other words, it can hold off intubation, maybe buy you some time, maybe not have to be intubated at all. For a COPD flare, for congestive heart failure from edema, or if somebody's frail upon extubation. You know, the patients that have been in the medical ICU for days or weeks, haven't gotten nourished properly, haven't wiggled or gotten out of bed, and they're deconditioned, those patients. Well, if you talk to your respiratory therapist, what they're going to tell you is the problem is none of the docs know what this stuff's about. Most of the docs understand ventilators, but when it comes to this non-invasive ventilation, they really don't deal with it. So I'm reminded of this video of my grandson, who is very determined, very hardworking. He really wants to embrace the technology, and he has grit, but he just doesn't quite understand the mechanics. So let's get into that. Well, I'm going to take a little foray through the literature so that we can sound educated on the topic and understand how the last 10 years has been so dramatic. First of all, extubation failure rate in an ICU is about 1 in 4. So we certainly can't perceive ourselves to be experts in knowing when to extubate. So then you say, well, let's use non-invasive ventilation as an alternative to just conventional oxygen in patients at high risk for extubation failure. Well, back about 10 years ago, there was this couple of papers that got everybody all excited. You could decrease reintubation. You could decrease ICU mortality. And you can increase 90-day survival. Well, who doesn't want that? So you get excited and you say, well, let's go do this non-invasive ventilation when we extubate people. And then they say, well, another article came out right about that same time that CPAP and BiPAP can decrease left ventricular afterload and improve patients in terms of pulmonary edema. In fact, there was a 23-center, 1,000 randomized controlled trial that showed that you would get a faster improvement on CPAP or BiPAP. Unfortunately, there wasn't a mortality difference, but if you're going to get better, it's got to be better somehow, right? So it still sort of lended credibility to the whole idea of non-invasive ventilation. Then along about that time, we had 3 articles come out that said, well, you know, and patients should have COPD that get in trouble and have hypercapnia, it doesn't really help. There's no improvement in mortality or intubation numbers, so I don't know what the excitement's all about. However, if you properly choose your patients in a prospective randomized study, if they're somewhat acidotic and they've got some retention of CO2 and have a respiratory acidosis and they're breathing fast in those settings, BiPAP will decrease your mortality and decrease your intubation rate. So you can spin it either way. Let's go a little further. If you're immunocompromised and you're admitted to the ICU for respiratory failure due to immunocompromisation, like somebody who's had a transplant or somebody who's immunocompromised from chemotherapy, then CPAP or BiPAP will do better than conventional O2, and it's an independent predictor of survival and has a decreased need for intubation. There's a bunch of articles about 6-7 years ago that show that. Okay, so we're starting to get a handle on this. Now, what about acute lung injury, ALI? Well, if you do non-invasive ventilation on those patients, 3 major articles, all kind of one right after the other, said it doesn't really help the patient. In fact, they may get worse. So now you've got about 10 years worth of literature where you're supposed to get all excited, then you're supposed to back off. Then you're supposed to get all excited, and you're supposed to back off. So, in fact, in a big recent review in critical care medicine, yeah, COPD looked pretty good. And cardiogenic edema looked pretty good with non-invasive ventilation. And post-extubation failure looked pretty good. But hypoxic respiratory failure, yeah, not so good. In fact, you'd have an increased rate of failure and death if you use non-invasive ventilation. Well, the debate raged on. And those of you that were doing critical care during that period of time, you had respiratory therapists that were BiPAPers and you had CPAPers, and you were sort of caught in the middle. But 3 years or 4 years ago, out snuck high-flow nasal cannulas. There's two major companies that make it, Optiflow, which has a 1 to 6 liter flow per minute, and a Precision Flow, which is 5 to 40 liters per minute. Interestingly enough, this was initially used in neonates. Back when I used to do ECMO on neonates and did neonatology, I had to learn about high-flow nasal cannulas. So it worked great, little newborns, and kind of got to understand that it was comfortable for them and they could do stuff, but I never thought it would work in adults. Well, that's why I regret the fact I have no conflicts, because if I'd thought of it, it was expanded to adults about 10 years ago, and you can adjust the FiO2. You can heat and humidify the flow of that air. So all that stuff about nasal cannulas drying your nose out and causing bleeding, that's gone. And it's better tolerated than CPAP and BiPAP. Now, right now, there's no real consensus for initial flow, weaning, or direct indications, but it's really starting to catch on, and then it was a big critical care review just a few months ago. Now, the New England Journal of Medicine article from 3 years ago is what made everybody aware of this. It was a multi-center open-label trial where they looked at acute respiratory failure with a PDF ratio less than 300. Now, every surgeon in the room knows you're not all that sick with a PDS less than 300. But nevertheless, your label is acute respiratory failure. And high-flow oxygen versus face mask versus non-invasive pulmonary ventilation were compared in a 28-day study. Turns out that high-flow oxygen had a significant improvement in intubation rate, ventilator-free days, and survival. So now we have a really good study comparing all three popular modalities, and you've got an increase in survival. Well, I can say that once you get something that everybody agrees to, it catches on like wildfire. Because now you have high-flow oxygen where you can adjust the flow in the oxygen. The mouth is unobstructed so the patient can talk, eat, and here's the kicker for surgeons. Now, if you haven't listened at all up until now, this is when you need to listen, because this mode of treatment and high-flow oxygen allows your patient to vomit without aspirating. All those years that I had to worry about a face mask, all those years that I had somebody saying, if you just used CPAP or BiPAP, you might not have to intubate this patient. And the next thing I'd worry about was whether or not their stomach was filling with air and they were going to vomit and fill the mask. You don't have to worry about that now with high-flow nasal cannula. Ambulation is easier because this apparatus I show you here can be held by the patient and walked around. And it quickly became standard in our trauma, cardiac, and transplant ICU. In fact, high-flow nasal cannula is now preferred for lung transplant. So what if you're an ECMO doctor? Everybody up here has done ECMO or is an expert in ECMO or wants to do more ECMO. So the ECMO ELSO guidelines for endotracheal extubation in patients with respiratory failure receiving venovenous ECMO. Quote, consider extubating to non-invasive positive pressure ventilation if potentially PEEP dependent. I never know somebody's potentially PEEP dependent. I think I'm potentially PEEP dependent because I'm up here huffing and puffing. The bottom line is I can never quite tell what that means. So I extubate patients on ECMO and always put them on nasal high-flow oxygen. So what's going on in the background? While you're in the operating room, you've just told the patient to be extubated in the morning or you did it yourself. You've now put them on some form non-invasive pulmonary ventilation just to keep them going post-extubation. What happens? Well, what you don't see is you've just mobilized a whole team. You get your respiratory therapist in there, you get your rapid response team, you get your critical care team, regardless of what their label is, if they're anesthesiologists or critical care doctors or whatever they are, but they're there, and they've got to make an assessment. They put the patient on non-invasive ventilation, and then they have to check the blood gas at about 60 minutes and see if they are better or not. If they're a whole lot better and they're comfortable, they may just leave them in some type of an observed bed or a progressive bed or a floor. But if they deteriorate or if they seem to need close monitoring, they'll go to the ICU. This is important because then when you come out of the operating and you go, well, where the heck's my patient? At least you know there's a protocol and there's a group of experts who've assessed your patient and decided whether or not they need closer observation or not. So in summary, what are the advantages of non-invasive ventilation? I've taken you through 10 years worth of angst and about a year, two or three's worth of, well, gee, this nasal thing seems to work pretty good. It's increased patient comfort, a decreased need for sedation with improved pre- and post-operative rehab because they can walk, oral nutrition, they're not intubated. You can avoid trauma and complications from intubation, such as aspiration and ventilator-associated pneumonia. And the patient morale appears to be better because they can talk to you. The disadvantages are, of course, is that when you put somebody on non-invasive ventilation, it's not instant satisfaction. Now, that's a real hard one for me. When I do something to a patient and I ask an intervention, I want it to work right then. I want to see better gases. I want to see a happy patient. I want to be able to brag to the family. But it takes some time. The patient has to settle out. They have to tolerate it. They have to feel comfortable with it. The other thing is, since you don't have a tube shoved down their throat, you have to worry about accidentally dislodging it and then becoming hypoxic and not necessarily in the intensive care unit where they're being watched so closely. There's no established airway access, and the patient may not want to or be able to comply. There's a certain amount of acceptance that the patient has to go through in order to have air shoved in their nose or on their face or have a mask on. And finally, the mask itself can cause irritation, and even the nasal cannula can do that. What are the contraindications? Well, if a patient has severe respiratory distress and you can't figure out what's wrong with them, you certainly don't want to go with non-invasive ventilation and go to the operating room. Then in that setting, you do want them in an intensive care unit because there's a likelihood that they will deteriorate. A decreased level of consciousness where they can't comprehend what's happening to them or they can't adjust to it. Inability to protect the airway and manage their secretions and cough. Or just a plain old uncooperative patient that just wants to be sick and spite you or pull their or they're disoriented and want to pull the mask off. So you've heard me talk a lot about the interface, a lot about the ability to tolerate the mask. And again, I get to look at one of these videos of my grandson, and it looks to me like he's got the game pretty well figured out, but his buddy there doesn't seem to be cooperating. And that's what it takes to be able to do non-invasive ventilation. You have to have cooperation between the respiratory therapist, the surgeon, and the bedside caregivers. Over 50% of non-invasive ventilation failures are related to that interface. So if there's a mask problem, or a nasal cannula problem, or the headgear is uncomfortable, it pulls on your hair, or pulls on your skin, those are things that can cause a very, very effective technique to fail. And I put this slide up because really the theme here is you gotta love your respiratory therapist. They're specialists at this. They've spent a lot of time to learn how to use it. They check for discomfort. They check for fit and the straps and the interface. They look for air leaks. They realign things to make sure that's not happening. They look at the nares and the fit of the nasal cannula to make sure it's not causing irritation or a nosebleed. They use tricks very much like a stomal therapist. Any of you who've done colon surgery or bowel surgery, you know that you don't want to be the one to do the stomatherapy. You want a stomal expert doing that. And that's what these guys are. They're the experts at managing these interfaces. Skin irritation and finally patients that become claustrophobic. You put a mask on some people, they just go nuts. So you've got to be careful that you're not prescribing a therapy that aggravates your patient. Well, any rate, this has been a good walk through the last 10 years worth of the controversy in non-invasive ventilation. And I would urge you to get to know about the high-flow nasal cannula, because that has literally taken over our trauma unit, our surgical and intensive care unit, and all of our CTICU, as well as our transplant patients. And that is now what we do at the University of Kentucky. So that's what I have to say, that I can play my harmonica for you, or I can tell you about non-invasive ventilation, but both, I think, will enrich your day. Thank you.